arrogance, knowing deep in their guts that everything in the world exists only to make them happy. Denna was faking it marvelously, but for Lord Kellan Brickjaw, it was as natural as drawing breath. I watched until they were halfway up the stairs to the third circle. That's where Denna stopped and put a hand to her head. Then she looked around at the floor, her expression anxious. The two of them spoke briefly, and she pointed up the stairs. Kellan nodded and climbed out of sight. On a hunch, I looked down at the floor and spotted a gleam of silver where Denna had been standing near the railing. I moved and stood over it, forcing a pair of Sealdish merchants to detour around me. I pretended to watch the crowd below until Denna came close and tapped me on the shoulder.
"Quoth," she said anxiously, "I'm sorry to bother you, but I seem to have lost an earring. Would you be a dear and help me look for it? I'm sure I had it on me just a moment ago."
I agreed, and soon we were enjoying a moment of privacy, decorously searching the floorboards with our heads close together. Luckily, Denna's dress was in the Modagan style, flowing and loose around the legs. If it had been slid up the side according to the current fashion of the Commonwealth, the sight of her crouching on the floor would have been scandalous.
"God's body," I muttered. "Where did you find him?"
Denna chuckled low in her throat.
"Hush. You're the one who suggested I learn my way around a harp. Kellan is quite a good teacher."
"The Modagan pedal harp weighs 5 times as much as you do," I said. "It's a parlor instrument. You'd never be able to take one on the road." She stopped pretending to look for her earring and gave me a pointed look.
"And who's to say I won't ever have a parlor to harp in?"
I looked back to the floor and gave as much of a shrug as I could manage.
"It's good enough for learning, I suppose. How are you liking it so far?"
"It's better than the lyre," she said. "I can already see that. I can barely play Squirrel in the Thatch, though."
"Is he any good?"
I gave her a sly smile.
"With his hands, I mean."
Denna flushed a bit and looked for a second as if she would swat at me, but she remembered her decorum in time and settled for narrowing her eyes instead.
"You're awful," she said. "Kellan has been a perfect gentleman."
"Talu save us all from perfect gentlemen," I said.
She shook her head.
"I meant it in the literal sense," she said. "He's never been out of Modag before. He's like a kitten in a coop."
"So you're Dinael now?" I asked.
"For now, and for him," she said, looking at me sideways with a small quirk of a smile. "From you, I still like Denna best."
"That's good to know," I said, then lifted my hand off the floor, revealing the smooth emerald teardrop of an earring. Denna made a show of discovering it, holding it up to catch the light.
"Ah, here we are."
I stood and helped her to her feet. She brushed her hair back from her shoulder and leaned toward me.
"I'm all thumbs with these things," she said. "Would you mind?"
I stepped toward her and stood close as she handed me the earring. She smelled faintly of wildflowers, but beneath that, she smelled like autumn leaves. Like the dark smell of her own hair, like road dust and the air before a summer storm.
"So what is he?" I said softly. "Someone's second son?"
She gave a barely perceptible shake of her head, and a strand of her hair fell down to brush the back of my hand.
"He's a lord in his own right."
"Skithi Ridavan,"
I swore. "Lock up your sons and daughters." Denna laughed again quietly. Her body shook as she fought to hold it in.
"Hold still,"
I said as I gently took hold of her ear. Denna drew a deep breath and let it out again, composing herself. I threaded the earring through the lobe of her ear and stepped away. She lifted one hand to check it, then stepped back and gave a curtsy.
"Thank you kindly for all your help."
I bowed to her again. It wasn't as polished as the bow I'd given her before, but it was more honest.
"I'm at your service, my lady."
Denna smiled warmly as she turned to go, her eyes laughing again. I finished exploring the second tier for the sake of form, but Threp didn't seem to be around. Not wanting to risk the awkwardness of a second encounter with Denna and her lordling, I decided to skip the third tier entirely. Sim had the lively look he gets around his fifth drink. Manette was slouched low in his chair, eyes half-lidded, his mug resting comfortably on the swell of his belly. Will looked the same as ever, his dark eyes unreadable. "Threp's nowhere to be found," I said as I took my seat. "Sorry."
"That's too bad," Sim said. "Has he had any luck finding you a patron yet?"
I shook my head bitterly. "Ambrose has threatened or bribed every noble within 100 miles of here. He'll be having nothing to do with me."
"Why doesn't Threp take you on himself?" Willem asked. "He likes you well enough."
I shook my head. "Threp's already supporting 3 other musicians. 4, really, but 2 of them are a married couple."
"4?" Sim said, horrified. "It's a wonder he can still afford to eat."
Will cocked his head curiously, and Sim leaned forward to explain.
"Threp's a count, but his holdings aren't really that extensive. Supporting 4 players on his income is a little extravagant."
Will frowned.
"Drinks and strings can't amount to much."
"A patron's responsible for more than that." Sim began to count items off on his fingers. "There's the writ of patronage itself. Then he provides room and board for his players, a yearly wage, a suit of clothes in his family's colors."
"2 suits of clothing, traditionally," I interjected. "Every year." Growing up in the troop, I never appreciated the livery Lord Greyfallow had given us. But these days, I couldn't help but imagine how much my wardrobe would be improved by 2 new sets of clothing. Simon grinned as a serving boy arrived, leaving no doubt as to who was responsible for the glasses of blackberry brand set in front of each of us. Sim raised his glass in a silent toast and drank a solid swallow. I raised my glass in return, as did Willem, though it obviously pained him. Manette remained motionless, and I began to suspect he had dozed off.
"It still doesn't add square," Willem said, setting down his brand. "All the patron gets is lighter pockets."
"The patron gets a reputation," I explained. "That's why the players wear the livery. Plus, he has entertainers at his beck and call. Parties, dances, pageants. Sometimes they'll write songs or plays at his request."
Will still seemed skeptical.
"Still, seems like the patron is getting the short side of it."
"That's because you only have half the picture," Manette said, pulling himself upright in his chair. "You're a city boy. You don't know what it's like growing up in a little town built on one man's land." "Here's Lord Punsington's lands," Manette said, using a bit of spilled beer to draw a circle in the center of the table. "Where you live like the good little commoner you are."
Manette picked up Simmons' empty glass and put it inside the circle.
"One day a fellow strolls through town wearing Lord Punsington's colors."
Manette picked up his full glass of brand and jigged it across the table until it stood next to Sim's empty one inside the circle.
"And this fellow plays songs for everyone at the local inn."
Manette splashed some of the brand into Sim's glass. Not needing any prompting, Sim grinned and drank it. Manette trotted his glass around the table and entered the circle again.
"Next month, a couple more folk come through wearing his colors and put on a puppet show."
He poured more brand, and Simon tossed it back.
"The next month, there's a play."
Again. Now Manette picked up his wooden mug and clomped it across the table into the circle.
"Then the taxman shows up, wearing the same colors."
Manette knocked his empty mug impatiently on the table. Sim sat confused for a second. Then he picked up his own mug and sloshed some beer into it. Manette eyed him and tapped the mug again sternly. Sim poured the rest of his beer into Manette's mug, laughing.
"I like blackberry brand better anyway."
"Lord Punsington likes his taxes better," Manette said, "and people like to be entertained. And the taxman likes not being poisoned and buried in a shallow grave behind the old mill."
He took a drink of beer.
"So it works out nicely for everyone."
Will watched the exchange with his serious dark eyes.
"That makes better sense."
"It's not always as mercenary as that," I said. "Threp genuinely wants to help musicians improve their craft. Some nobles treat their performers like horses in a stable." I sighed.
Even that would be better than what I have now, which is nothing.
Don't sell yourself cheap, Sim said cheerfully. Wait and get a good patron. You deserve it. You're as good as any musician here.
I kept silent, too proud to tell them the truth. I was poor in a way the rest of them could hardly understand. Sim was a Turin nobility, and Will's family were wool merchants from Raelian. They thought being poor meant not having enough money to go drinking as often as they liked. With tuition looming, I didn't dare spend a bent penny. I couldn't buy candles or ink or paper. I had no jewelry to pawn, no allowance, no parents to write home to, no respectable moneylender would give me a thin shim. Hardly surprising, as I was a rootless orphan Edema Rue, whose possessions would fit into a burlap sack. It wouldn't have to be a large sack, either. I got to my feet before the conversation had a chance to wander into uncomfortable territory.
It's time I made some music.
I picked up my loot case and made my way to where Stanchion sat at the corner of the bar.
What have you got for us tonight?
He asked, running his hand over his beard. A surprise. Stanchion paused in the act of getting off his stool.
Is this the sort of surprise that's going to cause a riot or make folks set my place on fire?
He asked. I shook my head, smiling.
Good.
He smiled and headed off in the direction of the stage.
In that case, I like surprises.
Chapter 6. Love. Stanchion led me onto the stage and brought out an armless chair. Then he walked to the front of the stage to chat with the audience. I spread my cloak over the back of the chair as the lights began to dim. I laid my battered loot case on the floor. It was even shabbier than I was. It had been quite nice once, but that was years ago and miles away. Now the leather hinges were cracked and stiff, and the body was worn thin as parchment in places. Only one of the original clasps remained, a delicate thing of worked silver. I'd replaced the others with whatever I could scavenge, so now the case sported mismatched clasps of bright brass and dull iron. But inside the case was something else entirely. Inside was the reason I was scrambling for tuition tomorrow. I had driven a hard bargain for it, and even then it had cost me more money than I had ever spent on anything in my life. So much money I couldn't afford a case that fit it properly, and made do by padding my old one with rags. The wood was the color of dark coffee, a freshly turned earth. The curve of the bowl was perfect as a woman's hip. It was hushed echo and bright string and thrum. My lute. My tangible soul. I have heard what poets write about women. They rhyme and rhapsodize and lie. I have watched sailors on the shore stare mutely at the slow rolling swell of the sea. I have watched old soldiers with hearts like leather grow teary-eyed at their king's colors stretched against the wind. Listen to me. These men know nothing of love. You will not find it in the words of poets or the longing eyes of sailors. If you want to know of love, look to a trooper's hands as he makes his music. A trooper knows. I looked out at my audience as they grew slowly still. Simon waved enthusiastically, and I smiled in return. I saw Count Threp's white hair near the rail on the second tier now. He was speaking earnestly to the well-dressed couple, gesturing in my direction. Still campaigning on my behalf, though we both knew it was a hopeless cause. I brought the lute out of its shabby case and began to tune it. It was not the finest lute in the Aeolian, not by half. Its neck was slightly bent, but not bowed. One of the pegs was loose and was prone to changing its tune. I brushed a soft chord and tipped my ear to the strings. As I looked up, I could see Denna's face clear as the moon. She smiled excitedly at me and wiggled her fingers below the level of the table where her gentleman couldn't see. I touched the loose peg gently, running my hands over the warm wood of the lute. The varnish was scraped and scuffed in places. It had been treated unkindly in the past, but that didn't make it less lovely underneath. So yes, it had flaws.
But what does that matter when it comes to matters of the heart? We love what we love. Reason does not enter into it. In many ways, unwise love is the truest love. Anyone can love a thing because. That's as easy as putting a penny in your pocket. But to love something despite? To know the flaws and love them too. That is rare and pure and perfect. Stanchion made a sweeping gesture in my direction. There was brief applause, followed by an attentive hush. I plucked two notes and felt the audience lean toward me. I touched a string, tuned it slightly, and began to play. Before a handful of notes rang out, everyone had caught the tune. It was Bellwether, a tune shepherds have been whistling for 10,000 years. The simplest of simple melodies. A tune anyone with a bucket could carry. A bucket was overkill, actually. A pair of cupped hands would manage nicely. A single hand. Two fingers, even. It was, plainly said, folk music. There have been 100 songs written to the tune of Bellwether. Songs of love and war. Songs of humor, tragedy, and lust. I did not bother with any of these. No words. Just the music. Just the tune. I looked up and saw Lord Brickjaw leaning close to Denna, making a dismissive gesture. I smiled as I teased the song carefully from the strings of my lute. But before much longer, my smile grew strained. Sweat began to bead on my forehead. I hunched over the lute, concentrating on what my hands were doing. My fingers darted, then danced, then flew. I played hard as a hailstorm, like a hammer beating brass. I played soft as sun on autumn wheat, gentle as a single stirring leaf. Before long, my breath began to catch from the strain of it. My lips made a thin, bloodless line across my face. As I pushed through the middle refrain, I shook my head to clear my hair away from my eyes. Sweat flew in an arc to patter out along the wood of the stage. I breathed hard, my chest working like a bellows, straining like a horse run to lather. The song rang out, each note bright and clear. I almost stumbled once. The rhythm faltered for the space of a split hair. Then somehow I recovered, pushed through and managed to finish the final line, plucking the notes sweet and light despite the fact that my fingers were a weary blur. Then, just when it was obvious I couldn't carry on a moment longer, the last chord rang through the room and I slumped in my chair, exhausted. The audience burst into thunderous applause. But not the whole audience. Scattered through the room, dozens of people burst into laughter instead. A few of them pounding the tables and stomping the floor, shouting their amusement. The applause sputtered and died almost immediately. Men and women stopped with their hands frozen mid-clap as they stared at the laughing members of the audience. Some looked angry, others confused. Many were plainly offended on my behalf, and angry mutterings began to ripple through the room. Before any serious discussion could take root, I struck a single high note and held up a hand, pulling their attention back to me. I wasn't done yet, not by half. I shifted in my seat and rolled my shoulders. I strummed once, touched the loose peg, and rolled effortlessly into my second song. It was one of Ilion's Tintatatornin. I doubt you've ever heard of it. It's something of an oddity compared to Ilion's other works. First, it has no lyrics. Second, while it's a lovely song, it isn't nearly as catchy or moving as many of his better-known melodies. Most importantly, it is perversely difficult to play. My father referred to it as the finest song ever written for 15 fingers. He made me play it when I was getting too full of myself and felt I needed humbling. Suffice to say, I practiced it with fair regularity, sometimes more than once a day. So I played Tintatatornin. I leaned back into my chair and crossed my ankles, relaxing a bit. My hands strolled idly over the strings. After the first chorus, I drew a breath and gave a short sigh, like a young boy trapped inside on a sunny day. My eyes began to wander aimlessly around the room, bored. Still playing, I fidgeted in my seat, trying to find a comfortable position and failing. I frowned, stood up, and looked at the chair as if it was somehow to blame. Then I reclaimed my seat and wriggled, an uncomfortable expression on my face. All the while, the 10,000 notes of Tin Tantatornin danced and capered. I took a moment between one chord and the next to scratch myself idly behind the ear. I was so deeply into my little act that I actually felt a yawn swelling up. I let it out in full earnest, so wide and long that the people in the front row could count my teeth. I shook my head as if to clear it, and daubed at my watery eyes with my sleeve. Through all of this, Tin Tantatornin tripped into the air. Maddening harmony and counterpoint weaving together, skipping apart. All of it flawless and sweet and easy as breathing. When the end came, drawing together a dozen tangled threads of song, I made no flourish. I simply stopped and rubbed my eyes a bit. No crescendo, no bow, nothing. I cracked my knuckles distractedly and leaned forward to set my lute back in the case. This time, the laughter came first. The same people as before, hooting and hammering at their tables twice as loudly as before. My people. The musicians. I let my bored expression fall away and grinned knowingly out at them. The applause followed a few heartbeats later, but it was scattered and confused. Even before the house lights rose, it had dissolved into 100 murmuring discussions throughout the room. Marie rushed up to greet me as I came down the stairs, her face full of laughter. She shook my hand and clapped me on the back. She was the first of many, all musicians. Before I could get bogged down, Marie linked her arm in mine and led me back to my table.
"Good Lord, boy," Manette said. "You're like a tiny king here."
"This isn't half the attention he usually gets," Willem said. "Normally they're still cheering when he makes it back to the table. Young women bat their eyes and strew his path with flowers."
Sim looked around the room curiously.
"The reaction did seem..." He groped for a word.
"Mixed. Why is that?"
"Because young Six String here is so sharp he can hardly help but cut himself,"
Stanchion said as he made his way over to our table.
"You've noticed that too?" Manette asked dryly.
"Hush," Marie said. "It was brilliant."
Stanchion sighed and shook his head.
"I, for one," Willem said pointedly, "would like to know what is being discussed."
Quoth here played the simplest song in the world and made it look like he was spinning gold out of flax, Marie said. Then he took a real piece of music, something only a handful of folk in the whole place could play, and made it look so easy you'd think a child could blow it on a tin whistle.
"I am not denying that it was cleverly done," Stanchion said. "The problem is the way he did it. Everyone who jumped in clapping on the first song feels like an idiot. They feel they've been toyed with."
"Which they were," Marie pointed out. "A performer manipulates the audience. That's the point of the joke."
"People don't like being toyed with," Stanchion replied. "They resent it, in fact. Nobody likes having a joke played on them."
"Technically," Simon interjected, grinning, "he played the joke on the lute." Everyone turned to look at him, and his grin faded a bit. "You see, he actually played a joke. On a lute." He looked down at the table, his grin fading as his face flushed a sudden embarrassed red.
"Sorry."
Marie laughed an easy laugh. Manette spoke up.
"So it's really an issue of two audiences," he said slowly. "There's those that know enough about music to get the joke, and those who need the joke explained to them."
Marie made a triumphant gesture toward Manette.
"That's it exactly," she said to Stanchion. "If you come here and don't know enough to get the joke on your own, then you deserve to have your nose tweaked a bit."
"Except... most of those people are the gentry," Stanchion said. "And our clever Jack doesn't have a patron yet."
"What?" Marie said. "Threat put word out months ago. Why hasn't someone snatched you up?"
"Ambrose Jackis," I explained. Her face didn't show any recognition.
Is he a musician?
Baron's son, Willem said. She gave a puzzled frown.
How can he possibly keep you away from a patron?
Ample free time and twice as much money as God, I said dryly. His father is one of the most powerful men in Vintus, Manette added, then turned to Simon. What is he, 16th in line to the throne?
13th, Simon said sullenly.
The entire Sirthan family was lost at sea 2 months ago. Ambrose won't shut up about the fact that his father's barely a dozen steps from being king.
Manette turned back to Marie.
The point is, this particular Baron's son has got all manner of weight, and he's not afraid to throw it around.
To be completely fair, Stanchion said, it should be mentioned that young Quoth is not the savviest socialite in the Commonwealth.
He cleared his throat.
As evidenced by tonight's performance.
I hate it when people call me young Quoth, I said in an aside to Sim. He gave me a sympathetic look.
I still say it was brilliant, Marie said, turning to face Stanchion, planting her feet solidly on the floor. It's the cleverest thing anyone's done here in a month, and you know it.
I lay my hand on Marie's arm.
He's right, I said.
It was stupid.
I made a vacillating shrug. Or at least, it would be if I still had the slightest hope of getting a patron. I looked Stanchion in the eye. But I don't. We both know Ambrose has poisoned that well for me.
Wells don't stay poisoned forever, Stanchion said.
I shrugged. How about this, then? I'd prefer to play songs that amuse my friends rather than cater to folk who dislike me based on hearsay.
Stanchion drew a breath, then let it out in a rush.
Fair enough, he said, smiling a bit. In the brief lull that followed, Manette cleared his throat meaningfully and darted his eyes around the table. I took his hint and made a round of introductions. Stanchion, you've already met my fellow students, Will and Sim. This is Manette, student and my sometimes mentor at the university. Everyone, this is Stanchion, host, owner, and master of the Aeolian stage.
Pleasure to meet you, Stanchion said, giving a polite nod before looking anxiously around the room. Speaking of hosting, I should be about my business.
He patted me on the back as he turned to leave.
I'll see if I can put out a few fires while I'm at it.
I smiled my thanks to him, then made a flourishing gesture. Everyone, this is Marie. As you've already heard with your own ears, the Aeolian's finest fiddler. As you can see with your own eyes, the most beautiful woman in 1,000 miles. As your wit discerns, the wisest of... Grinning, she swatted at me. If I were half as wise as I am tall, I wouldn't be stepping in to defend you, she said. Has poor Threp really been out stumping for you all this while? I nodded. I told him it was a lost cause. It is if you keep thumbing your nose at folk, she said. I swear, I've never met a man who has your knack for lack of social grace. If you weren't naturally charming, someone would have stabbed you by now.
You're assuming, I muttered.
Marie turned to my friends at the table. It's a pleasure to meet all of you. Will nodded, and Sim smiled. Manette, however, came to his feet in a smooth motion and held out his hand. Marie took it, and Manette clasped it warmly between his own.
Marie, he said, you intrigue me. Is there any chance I could buy you a drink and enjoy the pleasure of your conversation at some point tonight?
I was too startled to do anything but stare. Standing there, the two of them looked like badly matched bookends. Marie stood 6 inches taller than Manette, her boots making her long legs look even longer. Manette, on the other hand, looked as he always did, grizzled and disheveled, plus older than Marie by at least a decade. Marie blinked and cocked her head a bit, as if considering.
"I'm here with some friends right now," she said. "It might be late by the time I finish up with them."
"When makes no difference to me," Manette said easily. "I'm willing to lose some sleep if it comes to that. I can't think of the last time I shared the company of a woman who speaks her mind firmly and without hesitation. Your kind are in short supply these days."
Marie looked him over again. Manette met her eye and flashed a smile so confident and charming that it belonged on stage. "I've no desire to pull you away from your friends," he said. "But you're the first fiddler in 10 years that set my feet dancing. It seems a drink is the least I can do." Marie smiled back at him, half amused, half wry. "I'm on the second tier right now," she said, gesturing toward the stairway. "But I should be free in, say, 2 hours?"
"You're terribly kind," he said. "Should I come and find you?"
"You should," she said,
then gave him a thoughtful look as she turned to walk away.
Manette reclaimed his seat and took a drink. Simon looked as flabbergasted as we all felt.
"What the hell was that?" he demanded.
Manette chuckled into his beard and leaned back in his chair, cradling his mug to his chest.
"That," he said smugly, "is just one more thing I understand that you pups don't. Take note. Take heed."
When members of the nobility want to show a musician their appreciation, they give money. When I first began playing in the Aeolian, I'd received a few such gifts, and for a time, it had been enough to help pay my tuition and keep my head above water, if only barely. But Ambrose had been persistent in his campaign against me, and it had been months since I had received anything of the sort. Musicians are poorer than the gentry, but they still enjoy a show. So when they appreciate your playing, they buy you drinks. That was the real reason I was at the Aeolian tonight. Manette wandered off to fetch a wet rag from the bar so we could clean the table and play another round of corners. Before he could make it back, a young Sealdish piper came over to ask if there was any chance he could stand us around. There was a chance, as it turned out. He caught the eye of a nearby serving girl, and we each ordered what we liked best, and a beer for Manette besides. We drank, played cards, and listened to music. Manette and I had a run of bad cards and went down 3 hands in a row. It soured my mood a bit, but not nearly as much as the sneaking suspicion that Stanchion might be right about what he'd said. A rich patron would solve many of my problems. Even a poor patron would be able to give me a little room to breathe, financially speaking. If nothing else, it would give me someone I could borrow money from in a tight spot, rather than being forced into dealing with dangerous folk. While my mind was occupied, I misplayed and we lost another hand, putting us down 4 in a row with a forfeit besides. Manette glared at me while he gathered in the cards.
"Here's a primer for admissions."
He held up his hand, 3 fingers spearing angrily into the air.
"Let's say you have 3 spades in your hand, and there have been 5 spades laid down."
He held up his other hand, fingers splayed wide.
"How many spades is that total?"
He leaned back in his chair, crossing his arms.
"Take your time."
"He's still reeling from the knowledge that Marie is willing to have a drink with you," Willem said dryly. "We all are."
"Not me," Simon chirped. "I knew you had it in you." We were interrupted by the arrival of Lily, one of the regular serving girls at the Aeolian.
"What's going on here?" she said playfully. "Is someone throwing a handsome party?"
"Lily," Simon asked, "if I asked you to have a drink with me, would you consider it?"
"I would," she said easily, "but not for very long."
She laid her hand on his shoulder. "You gents are in luck. An anonymous admirer of fine music has offered to stand your table a round of drinks."
"Scut in for me," Willem said.
"Mead,"
Simon said, grinning.
"I'll have a Sauten," I said.
Manette raised an eyebrow.
"A Sauten, eh?" he asked, glancing at me. "I'll have one, too."
He gave the serving girl a knowing look and nodded toward me.
"On his, of course."
"Really?" Lily said, then shrugged.
"Back in a shake."
"Now that you've impressed the hell out of everyone, you can have some fun, right?" Simon asked.
"Something about a donkey?"
"For the last time, no," I said. "I'm done with Ambrose. There's no percentage in antagonizing him any further."
"You broke his arm," Will said. "I think he's as antagonized as he's going to get."
"He broke my lute," I said. "We're even.
I'm ready to let bygones be bygones.
Like hell, Sim said. You dropped that pound of rancid butter down his chimney. You loosened the cinch on his saddle.
Black Hand, shut up, I said, looking around. That was nearly a month ago, and no one knows it was me except for you two, and now Manette, and everyone within earshot.
Sim flushed an embarrassed red, and the conversation lulled until Lily returned with our drinks. Will's scutton was in its traditional stone cup. Sim's mead shone golden in a tall glass. Manette and I got wooden mugs. Manette smiled.
I can't remember the last time I ordered a Sauten, he mused. I don't think I've ever ordered one for myself before.
You're the only other person I've ever known to drink it, Sim said. Quoth here throws them back like nobody's business. Three or four a night.
Manette raised a bushy eyebrow at me.
They don't know? He asked.
I shook my head as I drank out of my own mug, not sure if I should be amused or embarrassed.
Manette slid his mug towards Simon, who picked it up and took a sip. He frowned and took another.
Water?
Manette nodded.
It's an old whore's trick. You're chatting them up in the tap room of the brothel, and you want to show you're not like all the rest. You're a man of refinement, so you offer to buy a drink.
He reached across the table and took his mug back from Sim.
But they're working. They don't want a drink. They'd rather have the money. So they order a Sauten or a Peverette or something else. You pay your money, the barman gives her water, and at the end of the night, she splits the money with the house. If she's a good listener, a girl can make as much at the bar as she does in bed.
I chimed in. Actually, we split it three ways. A third to the house, a third to the barman, and a third to me.
You're getting screwed, then, Manette said frankly. The barman should get his piece from the house.
I've never seen you order a Sauten at Anchor's, Sim said.
It must be the Graysdale Mead, Will said. You order that all the time.
But I've ordered Graysdale, Sim protested. It tasted like sweet pickles and piss. Besides...
Sim trailed off.
It was more expensive than you thought it would be? Manette asked, grinning. Wouldn't make much sense to go through all of this for the price of a short beer, would it?
They know what I mean when I order a Graysdale at Anchor's, I told him. If I ordered something that didn't actually exist, it would be a pretty easy game to figure out.
How do you know about this? Sim asked Manette.
Manette chuckled.
No new tricks to an old dog like me, he said.
The lights began to dim, and we turned toward the stage. The night rambled on from there. Manette left for greener pastures, while Will, Sim, and I did our best to keep our table clear of glasses while amused musicians bought us round after round of drinks. An obscene amount of drinks, really. Far more than I'd dared to hope for. I drank Sauten for the most part, since raising money to cover tuition was the main reason I'd come to the Aeolian tonight. Will and Sim ordered a few rounds, too, now that they knew the trick of it. I was doubly grateful. Otherwise, I would have been forced to bring them home in a wheelbarrow. Eventually, the three of us had our fill of music, gossip, and in Sim's case, the fruitless pursuit of serving girls. Before we left, I stopped to have a discreet word with the barman where I brought up the difference between a half and a third. At the end of our negotiation, I cashed out for a full talent and six jots. The vast majority of that was from the drinks my fellow musicians had bought me tonight. I gathered the coins into my purse, three talents even. My negotiations had also profited me two dark brown bottles.
What's that? Sim asked as I began to tuck the bottles into my loot case.
Bread and beer. I shifted the rags I used to pad my loot so they wouldn't rub against it.
Bredden, Will said, his voice thick with disdain. He's closer to bread than beer.
Sim nodded in agreement, making a face. I don't like having to chew my liquor.
It's not that bad, I said defensively. In the small kingdoms, women drink it when they're pregnant. Arwill mentioned it in one of his lectures. They brew it with flower pollen and fish oil and cherry stones. It has all sorts of trace nutrients.
Quoth, we don't judge you.
Willem lay his hand on my shoulder, his face concerned.
Sim and I don't mind that you're a pregnant Yilish woman.
Simon snorted, then laughed at the fact that he had snorted. The three of us made our slow way back to the university, crossing the high arch of Stonebridge, and since there was nobody around to hear, I sang Jackass, Jackass for Sim. Will and Sim stumbled gently off to their rooms in Muse, but I wasn't ready for bed and continued wandering the university's empty streets, breathing the cool night air. I strolled past the dark fronts of apothecaries, glass blowers, and bookbinders. I cut through a manicured lawn smelling the clean, dusty smell of autumn leaves and green grass beneath. Nearly all the inns and drinking houses were dark, but lights were burning in the brothels. The gray stone of the master's hall was silvery in the moonlight. A single dim light burned inside, illuminating the stained glass window that showed Tekum in his classic pose, barefoot at the mouth of his cave, speaking to a crowd of young students. I went past the crucible, its countless bristling chimneys dark and largely smokeless against the moonlit sky. Even at night it smelled of ammonia and charred flowers, acid and alcohol, a thousand mingled scents that had seeped into the stone of the building over the centuries. Last was the archives. 5 stories tall and windowless, it reminded me of an enormous waystone. Its massive doors were closed, but I could see the reddish light of sympathy lamps welling up around the edges of the door. During admissions, Master Lauren kept the archives open at night so all the members of the Arcanum could study to their heart's content. All members, except one, of course. I made my way back to Anchors and found the inn dark and silent. I had a key to the back door, but rather than stumble through the dark, I headed into the nearby alley. Right foot rain barrel, left foot window ledge, left hand iron drain pipe. I quietly made my way up to my 3rd-story window, tripped the latch with a piece of wire, and let myself in. It was pitch black, and I was too tired to go looking for a light from the fireplace downstairs, so I touched the wick of the lamp beside my bed, getting a little oil on my fingers. Then, I murmured a binding and felt my arm go chilly as the heat bled out of it. Nothing happened at first, and I scowled, concentrating to overcome the vague haze of alcohol. The chill sunk deeper into my arm, making me shiver, but finally, the wick bloomed into light. Cold now, I closed the window and looked around the tiny room with its sloped ceiling and narrow bed. Surprisingly, I realized there was nowhere else in the 4 corners I'd rather be. I almost felt as if I were home. This may not seem odd to you, but it was strange to me. Growing up among the Adema Rue, home was never a place for me. Home was a group of wagons and songs around a campfire. When my troop was killed, it was more than the loss of my family and childhood friends. It was like my entire world had been burned down to the waterline. Now, after almost a year at the university, I was beginning to feel like I belonged here. It was an odd feeling, this fondness for a place. In some ways it was comforting, but the Rue in me was restless, rebelling at the thought of putting down roots like a plant. As I drifted off to sleep, I wondered what my father would think of me. Chapter 7. Admissions. The next morning, I splashed some water on my face and trudged downstairs. The taproom of Anchors was just starting to fill with people looking for an early lunch, and a few particularly disconsolate students were getting an early start on the day's drinking. Still bleary from lack of sleep, I settled into my usual corner table and began to fret about my upcoming interview. Kilvin and Elxadal didn't worry me. I was ready for their questions. The same was largely true of Arwel. But the other masters were all varying degrees of mystery to me. Every term, each master put a selection of books on display in tomes, the reading room in the archives. There were basic texts for the low-ranking Ilir to study from, with progressively more advanced works for Relar and Elthe. Those books revealed what the masters considered valuable knowledge. Those were the books a clever student studied before admissions. But I couldn't wander into tomes like everyone else. I was the only student who had been banned from the archives in a dozen years, and everyone knew about it. Tomes was the only well-lit room in the whole building, and during admissions, there were always people there reading. So I was forced to find copies of the master's text buried in the stacks. You'd be amazed how many different versions of the same book there can be. If I was lucky, the volume I found was identical to the one the master had set aside in tomes. More often, the versions I found were outdated, expurgated, or badly translated. I'd done as much reading as possible over the last few nights, but hunting down the books took precious time, and I was still woefully unprepared. I was lost in these anxious thoughts when Anchor's voice caught my attention.
"Actually, that's Quoth right over there," he said.
I looked up to see a woman sitting at the bar. She wasn't dressed like a student. She wore an elaborate burgundy dress with long skirts, a tight waist, and matching burgundy gloves that rose all the way to her elbows. Moving deliberately, she managed to get down off the stool without tangling her feet and made her way over to stand next to my table. Her blonde hair was artfully curled, and her lips were a deeply painted red. I couldn't help wondering what she was doing in a place like Anchor's.
"Are you the one who broke the arm of that brat Ambrose Jackis?" she asked.
She spoke Aeturin with a thick, musical Modagan accent. While it made her a little difficult to understand, I'd be lying if I said I didn't find it attractive. The Modagan accent practically sweats sex.
"I did," I said. "It wasn't entirely on purpose, but I did." "Then you must let me buy you a drink," she said in the tone of a woman who usually gets her way.
I smiled at her, wishing I'd been awake more than 10 minutes so my wits weren't quite so fuddled.
"You wouldn't be the first to buy me one on that account," I said honestly.
"But if you insist, I'll have a Graysdale Mead." I watched her turn and walk back to the bar. If she was a student, she was new. If she'd been here more than a handful of days, I would have heard about it from Sim, who kept tabs on all the prettiest girls in town, courting them with artless enthusiasm. The Modagan woman returned a moment later and sat across from me, sliding a wooden mug across the table. Anchor must have just finished washing it, as the fingers of her burgundy glove were wet where they had gripped the handle. She raised her own glass, filled with a deep red wine.
"To Ambrose Jackis," she said with sudden fierceness. "May he fall into a well and die."
I picked up the mug and took a drink, wondering if there was a woman within 50 miles of the university Ambrose hadn't treated badly. I wiped my hand discreetly on my pants. The woman took a deep drink of her wine and set her glass down hard. Her pupils were huge. Early as it was, she must have already been doing a fair piece of drinking. I could suddenly smell nutmeg and plum. I sniffed at my mug, then looked at the tabletop, thinking someone might have spilled a drink. But there was nothing. The woman across from me suddenly burst into tears. This was no gentle weeping, either. It was like someone had turned a spigot. She looked down at her gloved hands and shook her head. She peeled off the wet one, looked at me, and sobbed out a dozen words of Modagan.
"I'm sorry," I said helplessly. "I don't speak..."
But she was already pushing herself up and away from the table. Wiping at her face, she ran for the door. Anchor stared at me from behind the bar, as did everyone else in the room.
"That was not my fault," I said, pointing at the door. "She went crazy on her own."
I would have followed her and tried to unravel it all, but she was already outside, and my admissions interview was less than an hour away. Besides, if I tried to help every woman Ambrose had ever traumatized, I wouldn't have time left for eating or sleeping. On the upside, the bizarre encounter seemed to have cleared my head, and I no longer felt gritty and thick with lack of sleep. I decided I might as well take advantage of it and get admissions out of the way. Sooner begun is sooner done, as my father used to say. On my way to Hollows, I stopped to buy a golden brown meat pie from a vendor's cart. I knew I'd need every penny for this term's tuition, but the price of a decent meal wasn't going to make much difference one way or the other.
It was hot and solid, full of chicken and carrot and sage. I ate it while I walked, reveling in the small freedom of buying something according to my taste, rather than making do with whatever anchor happened to have at hand. As I finished the last bit of crust, I smelled honeyed almonds. I bought a large scoop in a clever pouch made from a dried corn husk. It cost me 4 drabs, but I hadn't had honeyed almonds in years, and some sugar in my blood wouldn't hurt when I was answering questions. The line for admissions wound through the courtyard. Not abnormally long, but irritating nonetheless. I saw a familiar face from the fishery and went to stand next to a young, green-eyed woman who was waiting to queue up as well. "Hello there," I said. "You're Amelia, aren't you?" She gave me a nervous smile and a nod. "I'm Quoth," I said, making a tiny bow.
"I know who you are," she said. "I've seen you in the artificiary."
"You should call it the fishery," I said. I held out the pouch. "Would you like a honey almond?" Amelia shook her head. "They're really good," I said, joggling them enticingly in the corn husk pouch. She reached out hesitantly and took one. "Is this the line for noon?" I asked, gesturing. She shook her head.
"We've got another couple minutes before we can even line up."
"It's ridiculous that they make us stand around like this," I said. "Like sheep in a paddock. This entire process is a waste of everyone's time and insulting to boot." I saw a flicker of anxiety cross Amelia's face. "What?" I asked her.
"It's just that you're talking a little loudly," she said, looking around.
"I'm just not afraid to say what everybody else is thinking," I said. "The whole admissions process is flawed to the point of blinding idiocy. Master Kilvin knows what I'm capable of. So does Elk the Doll. Brandura doesn't know me from a hole in the ground. Why should he get an equal say in my tuition?" Amelia shrugged, not meeting my eye. I bit into another almond and quickly spit it onto the cobblestones. "Bah!" I held them out to her. "Do these taste like plums to you?" She gave me a vaguely disgusted look, then her eyes focused on something behind me. I turned to see Ambrose moving through the courtyard towards us. He cut a fine figure, as he always did, dressed in clean white linen, velvet, and brocade. He wore a hat with a tall white plume, and the sight of it made me unreasonably angry. Uncharacteristically, he was alone, devoid of his usual contingent of toadies and bootlickers. "Wonderful," I said as soon as he came within earshot. "Ambrose, your presence is the horseshit frosting on the horseshit cake that is the admissions interview process." Surprisingly, Ambrose smiled at this. "Ah, Quoth. I'm pleased to see you too." "I met one of your previous lady loves today," I said. "She was dealing with the sort of profound emotional trauma I assume comes from seeing you naked." His expression soured a little at that, and I leaned over and spoke to Amelia in a stage whisper. "I have it on good report that not only does Ambrose have a tiny, tiny penis, but he can only become aroused when in the presence of a dead dog, a painting of the Duke of Gibeah, and a shirtless galley drummer." Amelia's expression was frozen. Ambrose looked at her. "You should leave," he said gently. "There's no reason you should have to listen to this sort of thing." Amelia practically fled. "I'll give you that," I said, watching her go. "Nobody can make a woman run like you." I tipped an imaginary hat. "You could give lessons. You could teach a class." Ambrose just stood, nodding contentedly and watching me in an oddly proprietary way. "That hat makes you look like you fancy young boys," I added. "And I've a mind to slap it right off your head if you don't piss off." I looked at him. "Speaking of which, how's the arm?" "It's feeling a great deal better at the moment," he said pleasantly. He rubbed at it absent-mindedly as he stood there smiling. I popped another almond into my mouth, then grimaced and spit it out again. "What's the matter?" Ambrose asked. "Don't fancy plum?" Then, without waiting for an answer, he turned and walked away. He was smiling. It says a great deal for my state of mind that I simply watched him go, confused. I lifted the pouch to my nose and took a deep breath.
I smelled the dusty smell of the corn husk, honey, and cinnamon. Nothing at all of plum or nutmeg. How could Ambrose possibly know? Then everything came crashing together in my head. At the same time, noon bell rang out, and everyone with a tile similar to mine moved to join the long line winding through the courtyard. It was time for my admissions exam. I left the courtyard at a dead run. I pounded frantically on the door, out of breath from running up to the third floor of Muse.
"Simon!"
I shouted.
"Open this door and talk to me!"
Along the hallway, doors opened and students peered out at the commotion. One of the heads peering out was Simmons, his sandy hair in disarray.
"Quoth?"
he said. "What are you doing? That's not even my door." I walked over, pushed him inside his room, and closed the door behind us.
"Simon, Ambrose drugged me. I think there's something not right in my head, but I can't tell what it is."
Simon grinned.
"I've thought that for a..."
He trailed off, his expression turning incredulous.
"What are you doing? Don't spit on my floor."
"I have a strange taste in my mouth," I explained.
"I don't care,"
he said, angry and confused.
"What's wrong with you? Were you born in a barn?"
I struck him hard across the face with the flat of my hand, sending him staggering up against the wall.
"I was born in a barn, actually," I said grimly. "Is there something wrong with that?"
Sim stood with one hand braced against the wall, the other against the reddening skin of his cheek, his expression pure astonishment.
"What in God's name is wrong with you?"
"Nothing's wrong with me," I said. "But you do well to watch your tone. I like you well enough, but just because I don't have a set of rich parents doesn't mean you're one whit better than me." I frowned and spit again.
"God, that's foul.
I hate nutmeg. I have ever since I was a child." A sudden realization washed over Sim's face.
"The taste in your mouth," he said. "Is it like plums and spice?"
I nodded.
"It's disgusting."
"God's gray ashes," Sim said, his voice hushed in grim earnest. "Okay, you're right. You've been drugged. I know what it is."
He trailed off as I turned around and started to open the door.
"What are you doing?"
"I'm going to go kill Ambrose," I said, "for poisoning me."
"It's not a poison, it's..." He stopped speaking abruptly, then continued in a calm, level voice.
"Where did you get that knife?"
"I keep it strapped to my leg under my pants," I said, "for emergencies." Sim drew a deep breath, then let it out.
"Could you give me a minute to explain before you go kill Ambrose?"
I shrugged.
"Okay.
Would you mind sitting down while we talk?" He gestured to a chair. I sighed and sat down.
"Fine, but hurry. I've got admissions soon."
Sim nodded calmly and sat on the edge of his bed facing me.
"Okay. You know when someone's been drinking and they get it into their head to do something stupid, and you can't talk them out of it even though it's obviously a bad idea?"
I laughed.
"Like when you wanted to go talk to that Harper girl outside the Aeolian and threw up on her horse?"
He nodded.
"Exactly like that. There's something an alchemist can make that does the same thing, but it's much more extreme."
I shook my head. "I don't feel drunk in the least. My head is clear as a bell."
Sim nodded again.
"It's not like being drunk," he said. "It's just that one piece of it. It won't make you dizzy or tired. It just makes it easier for a person to do something stupid."
I thought about it for a moment.
"I don't think that's it," I said. "I don't feel like I want to do anything stupid."
"There's one way to tell," Sim said. "Can you think of anything right now that seems like a bad idea?"
I thought for a moment, tapping the flat of the knife's blade idly against the edge of my boot.
"It would be a bad idea to..."
I trailed off. I thought for a longer moment. Sim looked at me expectantly.
"To jump off the roof?"
My voice curled up at the end, making it a sort of question. Sim was quiet. He kept looking at me.
I see the problem, I said slowly. I don't seem to have any behavioral filters. Simon gave a relieved